Do you want to do the intro since you're a guest?
Is it like a format? Do I have to be like, hi, I'm Sage?
You don't have to give your full name if you don't want to. Just be like, welcome to the Outliers podcast and who you are. I'll probably say what my name is.
Hello, everyone. This is Outliers. I'm Sadie, and today we're going to be talking about the Games for Change conference with a background in education, human rights, and some of anthropology. I definitely was really interested in the Games for Change conference and had an excellent time attending with one of my friends.
And I'm Nick Allen. Y'all should know who I am, unless this is your first episode watching. So, Sadie, why don't you start us off telling us about yourself or Games for Change conference if you want to jump right into it.
All right. So, I honestly think maybe an anecdote would be pretty helpful here. So, I first heard about the Games for Change conference while working as a long-term substitute teacher at a Hillsborough County elementary school. I was looking for some games I could potentially use to keep the students engaged in some language arts lessons we were going to do after the state testing was over. And there were all kinds of really cool games that addressed these various themes, everything from mental health things to human rights crises to historical things, futuristic things, STEM things. It was just genuinely fascinating, just the amount of educational resources they had, and a decent amount of them were free. I had first heard of Games for Change actually a couple years before, though, when I was reading about the 2021 sixth edition of my favorite video game, The Oregon Trail. Yes, that was the video game I spent hours playing as a kid and have also spent hours playing as an adult. To clarify, so Games for Change is this parent organization that has produced a lot of these games, has the website that we've been talking about, and they also host a conference / convention in New York City every year. This year was actually their 20th anniversary, and so I went for 2 days of the convention. Nick went for one, and honestly, it was a really amazing experience in its own right. There were definitely lots of games and interactive things to do with regards to that, but there were also lots of panels. There were some like one-on-one type interviews that they called the fireside chats. There were also some workshops where you actually were engaged in what was going on, as well as some presentations of research, which was pretty cool in its own right. Think a live TED Talk in the New York Times building. Pretty cool, for me at least, as an audience member to experience.
Did you have a favorite panel?
So I honestly think I would have to say favorite fireside chat and then favorite panel just separately, because they're different enough in how this conference executed them for it to matter. I definitely would say that my favorite fireside chat was the one from the UNEP. It was genuinely fascinating because the entire collaboration between Games for Change and the UN was created as a result of the Sustainable Development Goals, and the UNEP was a huge part of that partnership. And in fact, there's like an entire dedicated office at the UNEP for using games to help solve climate change related issues. It's called Playing for the Planet. And the fact that like there's a mini UN agency about video games helping the world was just so cool in and of itself. That had to probably be my favorite. It also got referenced in a ton of other panels and fireside chats I attended, so it was kind of cool because it felt like it was the like origin story for a lot of the other cool events.
I feel like I missed so much. The one day I went was definitely memorable. I wish I was able to go more.
Honestly, I would be willing to go back next year because I, first of all, had a great time. And second of all, it was a really good experience in terms of, you know, not only was it like enjoyable, I felt like it was really good career-wise and would be for a lot of people. It's not obviously just about video games. And honestly, it was a genuinely good experience for me to grow as like a person and to learn more about different social issues and how we address them, but also to learn about things relating to education, things relating to psychology, mental well-being, physical well-being, and different topics like that. I expected it to be good. I traveled from Tampa to New York to do this, but it still exceeded my expectations tenfold, and I think that's really important to emphasize.
It was pretty amazing. At the time that I went, we were recording episodes for the podcast, and my favorite talk that we went to was the Dungeons & Dragons Get Straight A's. I can't remember if you were with me for that one.
I actually was not at that one.
It was interesting because it was unique in the way most people know what Dungeons & Dragons is, a role-playing RPG game. And depending on when we post these, you may have heard the talk I did with the teacher, Cade Wells, who had been using Dungeons & Dragons to teach students for 10 years. But him and a bunch of people from like the Dungeons & Dragons site, or the company, I should say, were talking about the skills that Dungeons & Dragons has been shown to develop within schools. And Cade Wells talks about how students who had him consistently had higher standardized test scores, higher college acceptance rates. He attributed it all to D&D because D&D builds those skills. If it's online at the time of this recording, I recommend you go give it a listen to. Cade Wells is really passionate about teaching and he's really passionate about D&D, and it makes for a really interesting talk.
I have watched a couple of his videos, not realizing it was the same guy until I was reading the descriptions on the first day of the conference, trying to figure out what to do throughout my time there. But I feel like that's just a really good testimony to the reach that he has, quite frankly. Admittedly, the main reason I had watched the videos were an attempt to host a Dungeons & Dragons, like, semi-virtual, semi-in-person group with some of the friends I made in college at FIU. Shout out to the FIU Model UN team in particular. But even as someone who has some experience working in public schools as a long-term sub, both for language arts and art for elementary education, there's definitely a lot of ways I can see where Dungeons & Dragons would be very applicable. Quite frankly, there were students that I can remember thinking, if I was able to run a club or do something like that, D&D would be a very tempting choice.
Another one I really liked, and I know, remember you were the one with me for this, was the Queer Games in the Apocalypse, where they talk about uplifting queer creators. And they,
yeah.
I forget who exactly was up there, but they all like, here are the games we're developing. And a lot of them had really interesting concepts. Some that, like, I've been playing video games my whole life, but none of the games I've played were anything like what these women were describing.
I was going to say, for my favorite panel, this Queer Apocalypse in Gaming was definitely my favorite. I think it's worth pointing out, I really do like any sort of post-apocalyptic fiction anyway.
Also, and it should be said, we're using queer in a reclaimed context. That was the name of the panel. I just felt to emphasize that.
No, I think that's an extremely good point to bring up, especially considering like every use of this is a direct quote from the organizers in terms of how they've decided to name the panels and whatnot. And honestly, I at least took it as a reference additionally to queer anarchism, which is the correct term for a political ideology that's basically focused around building communities and not relying so much on the government for support and for protection, but relying on each other. And I wrote a really long paper on that in college and think it's pretty interesting as a concept and genuinely fascinating. 10 out of 10 would recommend people read about, and was something I honestly was reminded of a lot by the stories that we were hearing in the panel.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember the names of all the women. Like, I have the list, and all of these women were either lesbian, bisexual, all parts of the LGBTQ community. But it was either like Colleen Macklin or Juno Mara who developed the game. It was like some cyberpunk type game where, and if you remember, please let me know. But she had these commandments all listed, and it was all interesting because it's a dystopian game. She talks about the rules that she made this around was no black women will die, no lesbians will die. And it's like, oh, lesbian sex will be spoken about. And when they are developing this game, this is what they're thinking about. This is how you empower the LGBTQ community by making that these core tenets of which the game is built around.
I will admit I took a ton of notes and I wrote those down, but I didn't write who specifically said them. But I definitely thought it was really cool to see with like guidelines like that, the game definitely didn't feel formulaic, but it was able to avoid some unfortunate implications that a lot of cliches and tropes we see in media have surrounding who survives in a post-apocalyptic story.
Like the classic kill your gays tropes for the homophobic era of the 1900s.
Yeah, the Hays Code really did a number with that one. But it's also just interesting because when it is a story where you just have a high amount of fatalities anyway, I feel like authors slash creators in general, not just writers, are able to get away with it a little bit more just because they're like, but I killed all these characters off. But honestly, what I really think was cool that they emphasized and genuinely one of the most amazing artistic statements from the entire conference was how they really emphasized the idea that if you're living in a post-apocalyptic or apocalyptic time and you have the ability to recreate society, how would you recreate it to be more just and to be more inclusive? And the idea that in some cases, when we think of societal collapse, obviously it's really scary, but there's some things about society that obviously are not ideal, and homophobia, sexism, racism among them. And if society were to collapse, maybe those could collapse forever too. And that genuinely, I was like, wow, I feel hopeful and uplifted by this story. And I think that's something that we don't often see in post-apocalyptic fiction in general across all media types. And it was just actually like inspiring to see.
Naturally, you know me, I leaned a lot more towards the video games that we were able to play. Most of them were VR, but all of them were educational or beneficial in some way, where it's like, this is a new kind of experience that I just never had before with games like Call of Duty or God of War, when it's just like, oh, maybe there's a good story or it's good gameplay, but this was an experience that I felt like I came to a new understanding, or I even learned something throughout. Like the Child of Empires game we played, it covered the 1947 partition of India and Pakistan, which is probably a topic you're infinitely more prepared to talk about than I am.
Just as a little context for people who might not know as much about the time period, the 1947 partition of India and Pakistan was ultimately created in the aftermath of World War II, during which the British rule in India was being transferred back to the people within the country. And long story short, through that process, the idea of creating a separate Muslim state was created and ultimately agreed upon by the powers that be. And that is where we have the literal geopolitical division of Pakistan and India today. And unfortunately, the way the borders were drawn, unsurprisingly, was not always the most clear and has led to some conflicts like the conflict in the Kashmir region today that still exist and still claim lives every year.
I remember they said in the game the lines were drawn by a man who had never been east of France or something like that, which is absolutely insane to me.
Absolutely. This is going to sound weird. Obviously, the Sykes-Picot Treaty is like the example of really bad borders drawn by guys from Europe. That would be the treaty that divided the Ottoman Empire, or what was left of it after World War I, up amongst the different European powers. And it was entirely based on how can we make the most money out of these states, and literally without regards to history, people's culture, and has basically set up every issue in the Middle East since 1917. So I would say this is probably a really good, you know, second, it's just, it's up there with that in terms of yikes borders drawn by guys from Europe. And that's like, there's so many yikes borders drawn by Europeans that stands out.
Yeah. I don't even know if I really want to call it a game. It felt more like an experience or a movie, because it's not really like you're controlling anything. Because throughout the game, quote unquote, you're listening to a Muslim man and an Indian man talk about their childhoods or what it was like before the partitions. And then they tell their personal stories of the migration that them and their families had to go on as kids.
It was definitely really interesting, and I totally second the idea that this is about an experience more than a game. There were definitely a few interactive elements, some of which, like, full disclosure, my first time using a VR headset was at Games for Change. So I was definitely like, wow, I can't do the like really basic mechanism because I barely understand how this works. So there definitely were interactive elements, but it was genuinely really cool to see the same historical events being retold from the point of view of two adolescent boys who are from the same village, ultimately end up living on two sides of a really contentious border.
I didn't even know about the partition of India and Pakistan until I saw this game. And as much as I like World War II, as much as I love movies on it, I'd never even heard about that. I feel like that's something that's definitely kind of a blind spot in our education system.
unfortunately, that's not totally surprising. I think especially because it happened after World War II, some of the aftermath stuff kind of gets brushed aside because it's like, okay, World War II, time to talk about the Cold War. And like some of the actual aftermath stuff gets actually, I would say, even less attention than the aftermath of World War I because it's often used as a prequel to World War II kind of thing.
Yeah. And then they also had Suella's story in terms of World War II, but that was kind of more focused on the Holocaust or the... I don't even know. Where was that supposed to take place? Because I know it was during World War II.
It was Croatia, I think.
Oh, Croatia? Oh, am I just completely off base with Suella's story?
It was somewhere in Eastern Europe, and I thought it was Croatia because I know that they had a large, like, paramilitary Nazi supporter group, and I kind of can remember thinking, oh, it's like that group that I had read about for a really cool graphic novel called Safe Area Garajda about the Bosnian genocide that you guys should totally read. Anyway, I can remember thinking that, but I also could have just thought, this reminds me of that part of the book, and it might not have actually been Croatia.
Either way, y'all can look up Suella's story online, but basically they take a photo from World War II that was taken as a result of the Holocaust, and it's of a little girl and a family, and it goes through the story of this family that's kind of taken by soldiers, and eventually, this is really sad, and I'm sorry for any listeners, they do end up getting shot, and it's meant to make you feel sad. It's an experience that's meant to tug at your heartstrings, but one that was artfully and beautifully done.
Definitely. I think that they did a really good job making the story feel immersive without feeling insensitive or without coming off as, like, cheap or gaudy. It genuinely felt like a good way to explore these historical photographs and historical records. And honestly, in a time when we are seeing anti-Semitism on the rise, we are seeing fascist sentiments on the rise, it is more important than ever, I think, to have really good quality Holocaust education. As someone who does not necessarily have a ton of direct background with teaching about the Holocaust, but who has studied genocide education both in high school and in college, I definitely felt like this was an effective means of doing that, and I say that with the credentials I do have and with the background I have, literally spent years studying genocide education, with that in mind, I thought this was up there with the best things I've seen.
We didn't mention this before, but Sadie, you have your bachelor's in international relations, correct?
I do, with a certificate in human rights.
And in high school, Sadie and I go way back, but in high school, she was even studying how do you best prevent genocide. This might be a small tangent, but how many steps are there in genocide again?
Ten.
Yeah. I know this is going to lead into a tangent because I know how much you can talk on the subject. I'm not trying to be mean. I just know you know a lot about international relations and genocide and all that.
No, it's okay. I'm only laughing because I'm thinking about how when I was doing the presentation for the AP research class, we had a maximum of 20 minutes and I had to keep editing my presentation because I kept going, I'm only laughing because it's actually really funny. But honestly, that could be an episode in and of itself. I studied international relations. I've taken multiple classes relating to a lot of these issues. Done multiple fellowships actually studying human rights education in general, including some for elementary age students. There was one book we even had. It was a picture book called The Terrible Things, an allegory for the Holocaust, and it was a way to talk about the Holocaust with a younger group of kids while informing them without completely traumatizing them. And honestly, that I think is an excellent segue back into the Suella story because it was educational and super impactful without being so graphic and disturbing that it ruined the ability to connect to what was going on.
Yeah, you get the sense of fear that those people had because it's VR. It's very much in your face.
It is quite literally in your face in many ways. But again, it never felt tacky either, which I think, not even just when it comes to things with the Holocaust or human rights, but when it comes to historical stuff in general, it's really easy for something to feel super tacky. And so the fact that really none of these games felt tacky, but especially the historical ones, and especially the ones addressing historical human rights topics, not feeling tacky is just genuinely pretty great.
And I don't want to make this seem like, oh, there's only history games. There's a lot more. It's just that with Sadie, I know we can always talk a lot about history.
To be fair, we did have a science game as well. The, oh my gosh, The light one with
Lost
the
in the Light was the name of it.
I was like, it had such a good name. Why can't I think of the name?
I wrote it down because I knew it was so easy to forget, but Lost in the Light. So this is a game meant to teach people about light pollution. You're playing as a bird who has to fly through Pittsburgh. And it kind of threw me off at first because basically you're flying through the city and when you go through a light beam, you essentially get like flashbanged. And it's really disoriented. If you run into a building, you lose. But the point is, it teaches you like about light pollution. And it has this whole thing going on about these birds, whenever they're migrating, they get thrown off by the lights. So like that's a major issue. I don't think they propose any solutions. They're just like, hey, just so you know, light pollution, this is a huge side effect of it, that these birds get confused and they end up not being able to find their way during migration.
There were a couple solutions at the very, very end. There was something about a specialty light bulbs that you can buy that have like less of an impact. And I believe there was information about ways you can help migratory bird species in terms of like what bird food to put in your feeders. Don't feed the ducks bread, give them frozen peas, that kind of thing. But it might have actually been in supplementary material that the students who made the game passed out. I'm honestly not sure. There was a solutions thing, but I can't think what specific part. That was the very first VR game I ever tried, so it definitely was really disorienting. 10 out of 10. Honestly, like, even higher than the 10 out of 10 for really nailing that experience for me, especially as someone who, just for what it's worth, is personally pretty scared of flying like in an airplane. Definitely was something I felt like I could relate to a little bit, the birds in general, with that fear, but also like having to experience multiple points where I'm like, wow, if this were real, I would have died right now and right now and right now and there too. And you know, realizing honestly how much of survival of the fittest just becomes like, can you not bump into a window? And how so many birds I've seen crash into windows were probably just unable to see because of the light was just really interesting and kind of disturbing, but also, again, really impactful. And I think it got the message across in a way that was effective.
Yeah, and if this game sounds fun to you, look it up, Lost in the Light. I know the students said they were going to try to get it onto the VR store. Hopefully they do by the time we post this. And then one of the things I played, I don't really think this was a game. It felt more like an educational tool, kind of like no more a game than you would say like Duolingo is a game. But it was a site like fingerspelling.xyz, which was something I think some grad students developed it. And there's probably going to be a video of me doing this on my Instagram by the time I post this. But they teach you fingerspelling and it has a webcam hooked up to your computer. It takes your hand, it scans your hand, and it's like, oh, spell this word. And you just mimic what the hand on the screen is telling you. And it's a way to help people learn sign language, which I thought was absolutely amazing.
I was really impressed with it. I'll admit, it was one of the few games I wasn't able to really test out. But I did get some of like the information they were passing out about it. And it looked like a genuinely really helpful tool for learning a really important skill.
Sign language is definitely something I recommend a lot of people learn. Even if there's not anyone deaf in your life or hard of hearing, they definitely appreciate it when they're able to communicate with someone who knows sign.
Absolutely. Also, just like tangent, as someone who's interacted with a lot of not pre-verbal but not full sentences kids in the setting of a public museum, sometimes they do know sign language. Of course, you'll obviously run into people who are deaf, hard of hearing, otherwise use sign language for that, but it's a pretty good way to communicate with a decent amount of our 2 to 3 year olds as well.
That's interesting. I didn't know that 2 to 3 year olds learn sign language. Some 2 to 3 year olds can probably know more sign language than I do. Dang.
I mean, honestly, they probably know more than I do too, but like it's been a little bit of like a parenting trend. I can remember some family friends doing it a few years ago and then noticing from the museum like more people are doing it, at least more people that I'm interacting with are doing it. I saw an article about it today, actually. I will send it to you to read later. I haven't gotten to read it myself yet, but it's just such an interesting concept, honestly.
I think the game that I probably thought was the most immersive and the one that I 100% want to play again is From the Main Square. It was an interactive game where you're in the same place all the time, but you're watching this civilization of kind of cartoonish looking people start from the very beginning, like from being caveman all the way to modern day civilization.
I mean, it was definitely like a whimsical, allegorical history of humanity / future of humanity. And it honestly was one of my favorite experiences at Games for Change. It was super impactful. That was really kind of interesting because they had a vaguely like surrealist type style in the sense of, like, for example, the cavemen had these creatures that kind of looked like woolly mammoths and were domesticated, but they weren't really any actual creature that exists. They just kind of looked like a cartoon generic Ice Age thing. I know that might sound like a random detail, but a lot of it, what I'm saying, is like kind of fictionalized, and I think that made it a lot more powerful. There were definitely things that I could tell were referencing real world events. Of course, there is like literally a rise of agriculture sectioned directly after we have our cavemen, but there were definitely some like visual cues that were referencing different things in human history, some of which really good, others not so much. There was a group of people that appeared to represent either Greek philosophers or people in a city-state inventing democracy, and then they turned into an angry mob. There was some imagery with people in hoods that were terrorizing the area. It definitely seemed to have some KKK imagery going on. There were a couple of random mass execution scenes as you get towards the end that definitely seem to be referring to the Holocaust and things like that. Obviously, most of this was not necessarily positive imagery.
No, it was terrifying watching it in the moment. Like, I thought, oh, this is so cute. And then you see soldiers line people up and shoot them. And then one soldier is like, I can't believe I just did this, and then shoots himself. And I thought this was just a cute little game. It was like, oh, look, people building buildings.
Yeah. And like, I have to admit, so something that I'm really interested in studying is prehistoric evidence for human rights. So I, of course, was like, agriculture, no, we should be egalitarian cavemen forever. It's only going to get worse. And then like 5 minutes later, I was like, oh my God, this got so much worse than I was anticipating so quick. There's a scene even where they build a concentration camp of sorts and put the very last couple of like cavemen people in it. And it's definitely reminiscent of what's happened to a lot of indigenous groups, especially within the Americas, of course, but also within sub-Saharan Africa. A lot of the hunter-gatherers that have been famously studied by anthropologists like Marshall Solins have been forced into what is effectively a reserve by their governments. And so that was just a really interesting detail that was also kind of horrifying, as I'm like, wow, the very beginning when all of this was nice and fun is getting herded up and treated like cattle right in front of me. This is terrible. The ending was really impactful as well. It honestly was a little bit more hopeful than I anticipated.
I don't remember the concentration camp, and I guess we didn't mention this, but it's called From the Main Square because it's a VR game and it's so easy to miss. Like, you could replay this whole experience 10 times and still see new things because you physically have to look around and see the whole world being built around you. So when you're playing VR, it recognizes, oh, where you're looking. And so if you look in one place, if you don't move, you will miss literally 90% of the story that's going on. So you have to look around and see the different things that are going on at the same time.
I definitely think part of what gave this one a lot of like repeatability, and I know there were things that I probably missed. I know that there were things everyone who's only seen this once missed because there's things going on all around you all the time. And it did, I think, a pretty good job of not committing too strongly to any one aesthetic, so it never totally felt like, oh, this is somewhere in the United States or in the Middle East or in Europe or Asia. It just felt like, oh, it's somewhere with people.
Yeah, and the art style actually spoke a lot into that because those people didn't really have any definable features. It's just people trying to live their lives.
Exactly. And their clothing and their architecture. There were definitely little things that seemed to reference real world cultures, but combined together and with some few generic pieces, like a, for example, generic military uniform or a generic king's crown, like those sorts of things tend to be a little more cross-cultural anyway, and so that helped as well. Yeah. I definitely thought the ending was really impactful. It builds up to something, but it isn't 100% hopeless. And that, I think, is what I will say about the ending.
We give like 20 spoilers. It's like, oh, but don't give away the last spoiler. There has to be some line we draw.
Especially when multiple things that we've at least covered in terms of spoilers, I really thought were going to be the end. The thing that you mentioned about the soldier shooting the civilians and then himself, I really thought was going to be the final shot of the whole thing, and I was absolutely stunned it wasn't.
Things can always get worse. They can 100% get worse.
Absolutely. It just seemed like a kind of good metaphor to close on, too. And so I'm like, wow, this is depressing and poignant. That has to be the end. Oh, wait. There's more.
So that's called From the Main Square. Look it up. I don't know if it's going to be free online yet. I really hope they do, because I have my own VR at home and I 100% want to download it and just sit there and relive it.
Yeah, I would definitely do it again, even if it was one of the more, I'm going to go with, surprisingly disturbing things that we saw. It was 100% worth rewatching and just absolutely fascinating. Excellent art style, excellent story. Really good use of VR and good use of video game technology. Totally recommend.
Since this whole thing has all been about the Games for Change conference, what do you feel about the uses for video games now? What can the future of gaming be given all the panels that you saw?
I mean, I think the future of gaming is definitely going to look a lot more sustainable, first and foremost. It was really interesting to hear a lot of the people representing companies talking about wanting to transition almost entirely to solar power, entirely to renewable power in some cases, and doing it in a reasonable amount of time and wanting to make the video games industry not completely terrible for the environment. But in terms of how games can be used, quite frankly, what we're seeing now is just going to be the tip of the iceberg of educational games in the future. I definitely think that the Oregon Trail is like the very prototype of educational video game. I'm pretty sure even my parents played it when they were in high school. Definitely kind of the cliche that we might think of. Duolingo might be a little bit more slightly modern thing we think of in terms of educational games, but I think that video games in general as a medium are becoming more recognized as a legitimate art form, and that video games as a means of education is just being adopted more. It's not like people haven't seen this before, but it's being adopted on a much wider scale and being implemented a lot more by educators, and I'm sure this will be the same for things that are non-video game games like Dungeons and Dragons or tabletop RPGs, as well as board games and like different things. For example, we heard a lot from Lego and Sesame Workshop as well, so games that are played not like analog is what I'm tempted to say, not electronically as well. Something that they emphasized a lot in multiple panels was how gaming in some way, shape, or form can literally be traced back to every civilization that's ever existed, and some sort of means of using play to pass on knowledge and traditions from one generation to the next. And I feel like carrying that into the future is something we're going to be able to do a lot easier, honestly, with organizations like Games for Change.
I'm really excited for the future of gaming. Do you have anything to close us off as we're kind of approaching the time?
This is coming from someone who might not really be that much of a gamer. I have played some video games. I played a few as a kid. Besides Oregon Trail, that was just like my absolute favorite. And I've played more as an adult, actually, than I did as a kid. But coming from someone who cares about education, who cares about human rights, who cares about storytelling and anthropology, this is something we shouldn't overlook. Video games should not be dismissed, and games in general should not be dismissed, and in fact should be harnessed as a means of creating accessible education for all.
Well, I'm Nick Allen. This has been Outliers. And I've been here with Sadie.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We appreciate it.
And have a great day.